in the Proverbs, it says, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. The message today that I want to give you comes from the book of Esther. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the book of Esther and the lesson that arises out of this book. Let me begin by just recapping the main plot of the book of Esther that it records. This book records events that took place during the period between when the Jews were brought back into the promised land and the coming of Christ, during that period of time. The book of Daniel, the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, all these books deal with some of the events that took place during this time. Israel went into captivity in Babylon in the time of the Babylonian Empire. They were brought back into the land and able to rebuild the temple during the time of the Persian Empire, something that Daniel is given a prophecy about that is referred to as troublous times when they were rebuilding the temple. They faced many difficult challenges and opposition from enemies that tried to destroy them or stop their work during this time. Daniel prophesies about four great kingdoms that rule the world during this time: the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire, and the succession of what would happen during this time. Well, the book of Esther takes place during this period, in particular during the second great empire, the Persian Empire, that existed during this time. The main characters that come in this story are, of course, Esther herself. She was a Jewish girl that became the queen of Persia. An amazing story that takes place in her life. Another important person that was involved in this is the emperor, the king, Ahasuerus, also known in other places as Xerxes, one of the great emperors of the Persian Empire during this period. King Ahasuerus is said to reign over a kingdom that stretched from India to Ethiopia. That's talked about in the first verse. It says, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. 127 provinces he ruled over from India to Ethiopia. Now Persia, the Persia was located in the modern, where we think of as the modern country of Iran. But this empire stretched much further than that, from India all the way to Ethiopia. That's all the way down into Africa, including the areas of Egypt and where the Babylonian Empire was, all the way into India on the eastern border. This was a massive kingdom ruling much of the world at this time, and that's the kind of empire that Ahasuerus reigned over. Another man that's involved in this story is another Jew named Mordecai. Mordecai is the cousin of Esther, and he is also older than her, and her parents died when she was young, and he raised her up as his own daughter. And he works in the palace, where in the city where the palace is. He works in the palace of King Ahasuerus. And so he's right there in the midst of this happening. Another person that comes up is someone named Haman the Agagite. And Haman is the enemy of the Jews. Haman in particular has a personal conflict with Mordecai. And that personal conflict has more behind it and what comes out of it than merely a hatred of Mordecai. But Haman represents an attack on not just Mordecai, but on the entirety of God's people. This story has some of everything. This is a great story. I mean, it has love and intrigue and hatred and deception and conspiracy. And all these elements are unfolding in this story. And it's just an incredible account of how God preserved his people. And it might surprise you if I told you that at the heart of this story, there is the concept of casting lots. It's interesting how this all comes together. But let me review the events that happen. Ahasuerus has a queen. And as it was with these Persian kings, you know, this is a very foreign kind of culture to us. They had many, many concubines, sometimes hundreds of concubines. And one of these wives of the king would be set up above all the others, and she would have the crown of the queen for the kingdom. And she would have the privileges that were above all the other concubines, all the concubines that the king had. And Ahasuerus becomes displeased with his queen, and he determines to put her away from being queen and replace her with somebody else. And so what happens is the nobles of the king, his officials, they gather up young women from all around the kingdom, and they bring them into the emperor's harem, essentially. And he has the opportunity to choose who he's going to set as queen, who he's going to raise up to replace the queen in her stead. And it's in this context that Esther is brought into the royal palace of the king and is loved, it says, above all the other women. And the king takes pleasure in her, loves her, and raises her up and makes her the queen. Meanwhile, during this whole time, she does not reveal to the king that she is a Jew. Now, think about what it must have been like for the Jews during this time. The Jews are present in the empire that's ruled by the Persians, but they are from a different people. They have different laws. They have different customs. They have different ways of living. Most significantly, they worship a different god. They worship the God of Israel. And so their customs and their practices and their way of life often brought them into conflict with the people that they were among. And they were the chosen people of God. And the spiritual context goes all the way back to the very beginning of mankind, when God said after the fall that the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman would have enmity between them. It goes all the way back to when Jacob and Esau are wrestling in the womb, and God foretells that the elder shall serve the younger. There's conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. There's conflict between those children of the devil and the children of God. And this spiritual conflict is going on all throughout history. And it was no different during this time of the Restoration. The Jews were scattered amidst the Persian Empire, and there were many people during that time that despised them and hated them. One of the events that takes place early on in this story is that there is a plot against the king. There are a couple of his chamberlains, it says, who were angry with him. They didn't like the king for some reason. We're not told why. But they devise a conspiracy to kill the king, to kill the king. As they're devising this conspiracy, Mordecai, who works, lives, dwells in this in the palace, Shushan the palace is what it's called, he catches wind of this plot to kill the king. Esther, his cousin, is the queen. He relays the plot to her, tells her about it, and she relays it to the king. The plot is foiled. The men that were devising to kill the king are hanged, and it takes special note in the book of Esther to mention that all of this was written down in the book of the Chronicles of the king. This is something that all the ancient kingdoms would do. They would take note, the historians of the kingdom, the scribes of the kingdom would take note of the significant events that took place. They would write them down for future generations or for the king to be able to go back and reference. And we are told that the scribes took note of this, wrote them down in the Chronicles of the king, and then it is almost forgotten about that this plot even took place. Another thing that takes place early in this story is the personal conflict between Mordecai and Haman. Haman is one of the king's officials, and the king promotes him up to the highest place of authority and honor. And one of the qualities that we see about Haman is a very proud man. Haman is very arrogant and lofty. And he wants to walk through the streets, and when he walks through the streets, he wants people to bow down to him and tell him how great he is and do what he says. And you know, at one point during the story, he gathers his friends and his wife together to tell them how great he is. It actually describes it that way. This is the kind of guy that Haman was. And Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman. And this Haman's servants, Haman's officials that work for him, take note of this. It goes on day after day, day after day. Finally, they go to Haman and they say, this Jew, Mordecai, refuses to bow down to you. And he, moreover, he's a Jew. And this is why he won't bow down to you. And Haman is very angry. And he wants to kill Mordecai, but interestingly, he considers the idea of just killing Mordecai to be utterly scornful. He turns up his nose at that idea. That's just not enough for him. It's not enough for him to kill Mordecai. He wants to destroy Mordecai and all of his people. See, this isn't just a personal conflict. There is a spiritual warfare that is going on behind the scenes. And Haman is not alone. Haman is not alone. We find out as this develops that there are enemies to the Jews all throughout the land that are ready, just given the opportunity, to go and to destroy God's people. They don't like them. They despise them. They hate them. They want to wipe them out, and they want to destroy them. And so Haman determines to set aside a day when the Jews would be destroyed. And the way that he determines to set aside this day is by casting what's called the pur, or casting a lot. Casting lots is something that was done all throughout the ancient world. There's actually not a lot known about how this was actually done, but the idea would have been to have some stones that were marked with something, or sticks that were each marked in a certain way, and they would be thrown down onto the ground, and they would be interpreted as to their meaning. The Israelites used lots to discern the will of God. There was a lot cast on the Day of Atonement, when the goats were brought in, and one goat was chosen to be the scapegoat. And this was done by casting lots. It was a way of something that we might consider to be an act of chance, like rolling a dice or flipping a coin, but was understood to be a way to discern the will of God. And so we see in this act that Haman isn't just merely acting out of blind rage. Haman actually is seeking to have the will of God be behind what he's doing. He cast lots. You know, they would cast, you know, should we do it this day of the month? Should we do it this day of the month? This day of the month? And then it would fall upon a certain day. And then he cast lots for the month itself. And he does this in the first month of the year. And he casts lots for each month in turn, and the lot falls on the 12th month, giving a space of nearly a year before this act would be carried out. And it describes him casting these lots. Remember the verse I quoted at the beginning. The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord.
Amen.
One of the most powerful things that you see revealed from the book of Esther is the way that the will of God is carried out in the world. And it is striking in the way that it is presented in Esther. It is striking, and I want to point some of those things out as this unfolds. Haman determines to destroy the Jews on a day. He also has to get authority from the king. So he goes to the king, and he presents his case to the king. We don't know too much from this about the character of King Ahasuerus. Sometimes he seems to make good decisions. Sometimes he seems to make incredibly rash decisions. Sometimes selfish decisions. Sometimes he takes advice and gets good advice. Sometimes he takes bad advice. But Haman comes to him and he presents his case this way. He says, there are people dwelling in our midst who are not like us. They don't follow our laws, they don't respect our customs, and they don't honor and respect the king's law. And we should utterly destroy them. Now, this is, as a side point, or as a point that's related to this, we ought to consider the question, are God's people who live in the world but are not of the world, are God's people good citizens of the place in which they live? Were the Jews really a threat to Ahasuerus' reign and the stability, the safety, the prosperity of his kingdom? In fact, the events that unfold reveal to us the very opposite. Mordecai wasn't joining in with the plot of these other chamberlains that he discovered. He didn't come over and say, the Jews would like to get in on this plot to kill me because we're Jews and we don't abide the customs and the traditions and the laws of the Persians, but we're opposed to them. Therefore, I'll throw my lot in with you and help you to undermine and destroy the king. No, he's a good citizen. He's a law-abiding, law-respecting citizen. It's the same with us as Christians. Paul writes to the Roman church. And he says to respect the authority. Romans chapter 13. He says, the powers that be are ordained of God. Therefore, submit yourself. They're put there for the purpose of restraining evil in the world, of punishing evildoers. God has set up these kings and authorities in the world. And it says the throne is established by righteousness. Just because God sets somebody up as a king or a ruler doesn't mean that rule is absolute or that rule is eternal. But God sets up kings and he takes down kings. God does these things. And here, Mordecai is respectful of the law. He's a good citizen, just like the rest of the Jews were. What did they want? They didn't want to undermine the Babylonian emperor Nebuchadnezzar when they were under his reign. They didn't want to undermine Cyrus or Xerxes, who succeeded him. They wanted to worship God. They wanted to build the temple. They wanted to return to their land and be able to worship the God of Israel. But this is the case that Haman makes. He puts it in the worst possible term, make them sound like just the scourge of the earth, who need to be wiped out and destroyed. And and Ahasuerus gives him the go-ahead. And so he establishes and sets up this day, sends out letters throughout the land that on such and such a day, go out, anybody who hates these Jews, go out and destroy them, wipe them out. You have the permission of the king himself, and we're even going to provide money to do it. Well, Mordecai hears about this, and he is grieved. He puts on sackcloth. He mourns. He fasts. And he gets in touch with Esther. And when he gets in touch with Esther, he says that you need to do something about this. You need to go to the king. Here she is, the queen. And he says, you need to go to the king and you need to beg him for the lives of the Jews, your people, my people. He needs to put a stop to this. And you have to understand that the relationship between Esther and Ahasuerus wasn't like the relationship between a husband and a wife today in our modern time. She was afraid for her life. Here was the law. If anybody, including the queen herself, went into the king's chamber, presented herself without his invitation, she could be put to death. And the only thing to keep her from being put to death is if the king, upon seeing her, would extend his golden scepter, basically saying that she finds favor in my sight and her life is spared, and I receive her to come. And so, at first, she's reluctant to do this. She said, don't you understand how the law works? If I can't just go in. In fact, she says, he hasn't called me in for 30 days to come into him. She's afraid. Maybe she's not in his best graces right now. So she's reluctant. But Mordecai says to her, basically, God is going to deliver his people. Actually, he doesn't say it that way. He says deliverance will come to this people somehow, some way. And it might not come through you, but it will come. And then he says, perhaps you've come to this place, to this kingdom, for such a time as this. See, he had a sense of destiny and purpose in the lives that were going on. Something very interesting about the book of Esther is that in the book of Esther, there's never any explicit mention made of God. And I believe it's completely intentional. Mordecai is spoken of as fasting. He talks about deliverance coming. He's sure. He's certain. He knows the Jews will be delivered. How does he know that? He believes that Esther is the queen for a purpose, that it wasn't just random chance. It wasn't just because she happened to have been the most beautiful woman that existed at the time. He believed she was there for that purpose, for that time, and that place. He has a sense of meaning and purpose and destiny in the events that are unfolding. Esther is afraid, but as a true hero is, they're afraid, but they act anyway. She's afraid, but she overcomes her fear. See, a true hero isn't someone that isn't afraid of anything. Someone who isn't afraid of anything is not human. A true hero is someone who is afraid. She's afraid of what could happen, but she acts anyway. She says, go and fast 3 days. Don't eat food or anything. He says, I and my maidens, we're going to fast as well. And then after 3 days, I'm going to go to the king, and if I perish, I perish. What did they do when they were fasting? What was the purpose of fasting? See, God is not mentioned. In fact, it doesn't even say fast and pray. It just says fast. And yet the two are always linked together in Scripture. See, God is intentionally shown to be behind the scenes and yet acting. See, we're seeing as Esther unfolds that in the events of life, God is wearing a mask. Often we do not see the face of God, and yet God is at work.
Amen.
God is at work. That is perhaps essentially what it means when it says the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. See, when you cast lots, when you casted lots in the ancient world, it was just an act of physical materials, stones or sticks being thrown and interpreted. They cast lots on the ship when Jonah was on the ship. And they didn't know why these terrible things were happening to them. And they were all going to be destroyed. And they cast lots, and the lots show that the lot fell on Jonah. He was the cause of this. The lot is cast into the lap. But the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. See, God is at work in the events of life that take place.
Amen.
In sometimes things that might have seemed insignificant, these events unfold and God is at work behind them. This doesn't contradict or conflict with the fact of human will and human choice. See, Esther, she could go before the king or she could not go. Mordecai says, you know, we're going to be delivered one way or the other, but perhaps you have come to this place for this purpose. God's going to deliver his people. But if you don't do this thing, if you don't take this opportunity, you will be destroyed. You will experience the judgment that will come down. But she goes before the king. She presents herself and he extends the scepter. He receives her and he says that he'll grant her whatever she requests. And she says, I want to have a banquet with you and with Haman. The three of us want to have a banquet and this is my request. And he grants her the request and they have a banquet. And for some reason that I still don't quite understand, when she has this banquet, maybe she's still a little nervous, or maybe she has a wise plan and she wants to see how this plays out, but she says, here's my request. And she says, I want to have a banquet, and at the banquet I'll tell you my request. And then she has the banquet, and her request is, tomorrow I want to have another banquet with the two of you again. And so they have the banquet. They go to their homes. Haman goes home. And he gathers everybody together in his family, his wife. And he tells them about how great he is, how great his kingdom is. And not only that, but the queen held a banquet. And she didn't just invite the king, but of all the king's servants, the only one she invited was me. Something else had happened. And something else happened that night. Again, in seemingly perhaps insignificant events, we see that God is at work in what's taking place, and that there is purpose and there is intention in the events of our lives. And we ought to look at our lives and not just think that the things that happen to us and the opportunities we have and the places that we're brought are without purpose and without meaning, but see that there is intention and there is purpose. Something else happened that night. That night, the king couldn't sleep. And the king couldn't sleep, so he calls his servants to bring them the chronicles and read them to him. I don't know why this was. Maybe he was troubled and he felt like there was something in them that he needed to be reminded of. Or maybe listening to the king's chronicles are just a good way to fall asleep when you can't sleep. So they come and they bring him and they're reading him. And they read him, you know, you think this is by chance? They read him the account of when there was the plot against the king's life and Mordecai foiled the plot of the king. He hears this. And the next day, he's thinking, has anything ever been done? In fact, he calls Haman and he says, Haman, or no, he asks his other servants, he says, has anything ever been done for this man that foiled this plot? And they say, nothing was done to reward him. And so he calls Haman in, and he says, Haman, what should be done to someone in whom the king delights? And Haman, of course, is so arrogant. He hears this, and he thinks, who could the king possibly be talking about other than me? And so he says, well, he should be paraded through the streets. He should have the king's robe put on him, the king's ring, and people should be going before him, you know, leading the way. The king's best servant should be going before him and saying, this is what should be done to a man in whom the king delights. And the king says, great, you go do that for Mordecai. So Haman, you know, and this book has the greatest ironies of perhaps anything I've ever read. Haman has to lead through the street Mordecai, his bitter rival and enemy, and proclaim before the entire people, this is what will be done for a man in whom the king delights. Haman has to do this. When it's done, he goes home and he's furious. Even with all the great things that seem to be happening, he says, I just can't be happy as long as Mordecai is alive. So he calls his family together, and here's another example of, you know, you have to be careful whose advice you take in life. There's a lot of that in this. He calls his family together and he says, I just can't be happy as long as Mordecai lives. And they say, well, build a gallows and have him hanged on it. And this, you know, makes him feel a little bit better. He builds a gallows. He goes that night to the banquet with the king and with the queen Esther. And he comes to the banquet, and the king asks Esther, what is it that you request? And she says, give me the life of my people. She said, we've been sold to death. Somebody has sold us to be put to death, to be wiped out, exterminated. She said, if we had been sold just to be slaves, I would have held my peace, but our lives are sold. Of course, the king is furious. The king's angry because he loves this queen. She's the one he loves above all others. It seems unjust. He said, who has done this? She said, this wicked Haman has done this. The king storms out. Oh, and to get this picture a little bit, you have to think about how people sat in the ancient world when they had banquets. They weren't seated, you know, upright at tables like we are. They laid down on these couches. They laid down, they reclined. And so the king storms out. He's furious. Here Haman had made a plot to wipe out the people of his very queen. Well, Haman didn't realize this. He made a fatal mistake in his wicked plot. And so he flies over to Esther's bed where she's lying down and begins to beg her, to plead with her, to spare him. He realizes the predicament that he's in. Meanwhile, the king comes back in and he sees Haman doing this, and he says, you know, it's not enough for you to kill the queen. You're going to force the queen also. And then, you know, as this is happening, one of the king's servants comes to the king and says, oh, by the way, Haman built a gallows at his house to hang Mordecai, who saved your life. And with that, the plots of Haman are brought to an end. But there's still this decree that had gone out to all the land. And so Esther goes again to the king, one more time going. And she is a mediator for her people. She is someone to stand in the place of judgment. See, she risks her own life on behalf of her people. She goes before the king again. Again, he extends the scepter to her, and he offers to grant her request, and she tells him about the decree that had gone out in all the land to have her people wiped out on this day, in the 12th month, in the 13th day, all the enemies of the Jews are going to get together, and they're going to go out and they're going to kill my people. And she says, you know, protect us, give us the opportunity to protect ourselves, give us the authority to fight back against our enemies. And he grants her request. And that day in which, rather than the enemies of God's people having the victory over them, God's people had the victory over their enemies, that day became known as the Feast of Purim, named after the casting of the Purim, which was the thing that determined the day. Why does that take such a central place in this story? Because of that very reason, that it shows that in all the events that took place, in all the twists and turns of this story, truly an amazing series of events that unfold, in all the twists and turns, God's hand is at work to preserve and to keep his people. This feast would be one that would be celebrated by the Jews in remembrance of this day when they had victory over their enemies, and their enemies did not have victory over them, would be celebrated continually forever after that time. And they would commemorate how on that day God gave them deliverance from their enemies. We see through the story that Esther tells many lessons, but one of them is that the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Why couldn't the king sleep that night? Why did Mordecai happen to be there to overhear that plot? Why was this one Jewish girl who'd been brought along with her cousin and many others into captivity, into exile, why did she end up queen at that time, at just such a time? See, the Lord is at work to preserve his people through the twists and turns of life. It says time and chance happeneth to all. And it does. And the events of life, the twists and turns of our path, may often hide from us the face and the hand of God. We might not see it. Just like in the book of Esther, God's name never explicitly mentioned. And yet you can't read this book without seeing him at work, without seeing that when Esther, in that fateful moment, put her own life on the line to be a mediator for her people, when she went into the king's chambers and she said, if I perish, I perish. When she, for 3 days, had all the people, she says, fast for me. You can't help but see that her hope was that God would give her deliverance, that God would grant her favor in the eyes of the king. And so we see in the events that happen, God's hand at work. And we see God's hand at work also when our mediator, when Jesus Christ went to his death on our behalf, and all the things that happened, that took place, born at certain time and place, when Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were all united together. Peter says they were united together to do whatsoever thy hand and thy purpose had purpose to be done. That the purpose of God to preserve his people, to protect us from destruction, to keep us. We see in this the providence of God at work. The word providence means the providence of God, that God provides for the deliverance and the salvation of his people. We see that in the book of Esther, and we see it most of all in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you for your attention this morning. God bless.